All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys, on the line, I've got the great Eric Margolese. EricMargolese.com. Spell it like Margolis. EricMargolese.com. And, of course, he wrote the great books War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And War at the Top of the World. He really did spend a lot of time in previous years over there at one of the major crossroads of the world at the highest elevations there between India, China, and the Afghan-Pakistan, you know, region there. All around there, Kashmir and all of that stuff. Great book. Man, and I'm telling you, you know what? If you've been reading Eric Margolese articles for years and you know how great he is, you'll still be blown away by how great the book War at the Top of the World is. And American Raj, too. I mean, they're both so great. But anyway, so the reason I have you on, Eric, is because you're a guy I know, and you know about this extremely important issue that there are so very few experts on, and that is the relationship between China and India, which has come very much to a head in the last week as soldiers on both sides have been killed in skirmishes up there at the top of the world. So first of all, welcome back, my old friend. How are you? And glad to talk to you again.
I'm living under house arrest, but I'm okay with it. I needed a little break from the rest of the world, and I'm fighting off evil viruses and still fighting with crazy people in the media.
That's right. See, you got your priorities straight, making the best of a bad situation. Good to know. I'm glad to know that you're doing well. And listen, so, man, is it really right? These guys, I read a thing. They had clubs wrapped in barbed wire. The Chinese did and beat the Indians to death there in some borderland skirmish over where the line really is.
Yeah, they can be real nasty, those guys. The Chinese are brutal and the Indians are no better. So in the past, most of the fighting was hand-to-hand or fisticuffs because they were denied the right to use weapons. But in this latest clash that happened last week, apparently both sides used small arms and caused a number of casualties.
Yeah, I read a thing. These guys talking about swinging a board with nails through the end of it. I thought of Mo Sizlak from The Simpsons, you know, these guys, which at least they're not machine gunning each other to death. But what a brawl that must have been if these guys were actually beaten to death with boards with nails sticking out of the end. My God, there must be a YouTube of that somewhere, right?
Well, there have been
an Instagram
brawls over the last decades between Indian and Chinese troops. And being up there at high altitude, we're talking 14,000 feet, makes you weird and crazy. And people are really bored and will do anything to change that.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, this gets right to the heart of it, right? Are we talking about, you know, quote unquote, like rogue kind of very low level authority troop groups going around, you know, stumbling around, walking this side of the ridge instead of that one and crossing the line? Are we talking about a real change in policy between the Chinese and or Indian governments towards each other that has resulted in this?
Well, that's the right question, Scott. There have been small-time clashes over the years, and the troops were under orders to keep them calm, not expand into heavy warfare. The last time the two sides really fought it out was in 1962, when Jawaharlal Nehru in India got too big for his britches or his dhoti or whatever and started pushing the Chinese in the Himalayas. And the Chinese struck back, as Mao put it, to teach him a lesson. And the lesson was taught. The Indians got their behinds whipped by the Chinese, and the Chinese were really could have swept down right to Calcutta until Mao called everything off and said, well, I taught the Indians a lesson. And the Indians did learn the lesson. They avoided conflict for decades.
Yeah. So now, I guess I read a thing that said that this was, and I mean, they're both very new states, right? You know, created after World War II. So it's always kind of questionable about where this line was supposed to be. But I read a thing that said what the common international conception is that the Chinese actually moved the line into Indian territory. If anybody's in the wrong, it's them. Is that right?
Well, both sides make those kind of claims. In fact, nobody knows where the hell the line is.
British, there's no line, right? It's all make-believe anyway.
When the British Empire ruled India, the famous Indian Raj, but which my book, American Raj, is about in part, that used to be Tibet, and a huge, ill-defined place that nobody cared about because it was too high and cold and airless, etc. But that changed. The British drew the lines with thick-nibbed pens, and these pens covered over old valleys and mountain ranges and things. So the British did a lousy job of demarcation. And as with many border disputes, it came to life years later after the Chinese invaded Tibet in 1951, I think. And they came right up next to the Indians, and the Indians suddenly got scared because they had not taken any action. They had ignored the area totally. And all of a sudden they found the Red Chinese Army next door, and they panicked. And hence the clashes began that led to the 62-63 wars. Mm-hmm.
And now, but good old mutually assured destruction is going to keep the overall peace here, right?
Well, not maybe. These are both countries with lots of nuclear weapons, very powerful military forces. And I don't think that there will be a large war there, though I predicted one in my book. I said one day India and China will fight to control the Himalayas and the Karakorams. And the most important region is that this area, obscure as it is, has the headwaters of all the major rivers in India and Pakistan and Burma. So it is the water source for Southeast Asia, and it's of great importance to all concerned.
Yeah, well then, I mean, the question and answer are raised obviously and immediately, right, that instead of warring over that they should create an international consortium that can negotiate and share those resources alike.
They lack the wisdom, Scott. And look at the Egyptians and the Ethiopians right now are threatening war with each other over the Nile waters. So, and this is a dispute that goes back to the 1920s, I think. So it's very contentious. And they're also in conflict of Burma, next door Burma, which is very strategic. And, you know, they're great powers. Each wants to be the big dog on the block.
Hey, guys, Scott Horton here for Mike Swanson's great book, The War State. It's about the rise of the military-industrial complex and the power elite after World War II, during the administrations of Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, and Jack Kennedy. It's a very enlightening take on this definitive era on America's road to world empire. The War State by Mike Swanson. Find it in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Mike Swanson is a successful Wall Street trader with an Austrian school understanding of the markets, and therefore he has great advice to share with you. Check out Mike's work and sign up for his list at wallstreetwindow.com. And that's what you'll get, a window into all of Mike's trades. He'll explain what he's buying and selling and expecting and why. I know you'll learn and earn a lot. WallStreetWindow.com. That's WallStreetWindow.com. So now what about the Chinese role in Kashmir? Because they actually share one of those borders too, right?
Yeah, there's a chunk of territory right next to Ladakh called Aksai Chin. And Aksai Chin has a population of, I think, 14,000 yak herders or something and nothing else. But it's way, way up in the mountains. It's freezing cold. There's no oxygen. It's half the oxygen at sea level. But it is very important, as is Ladakh, because that is the route that links China with Tibet. And it is the greatest strategic importance. And it also is the center point for moving troops around in the area. Mm-hmm. So it's very sensitive.
And then this is an interest that they share in common with Pakistan. They kind of have a de facto alliance against India there, even though India really controls Kashmir, right?
That's right. Well, coming back to Aksai Chin, it was part of Pakistan. Pakistan or Pakistani Kashmir. Pakistan then gave Aksai Chin to China because to help its strategic situation in Tibet. And the Indians went crazy, and the Indians have never accepted it. And now the Kashmir issue has come back alive again. It's been in a dispute since 1948. It's the oldest dispute in front of the UN. But the Indians, the new nationalist, extreme right-wing government in India, of the Bharat Janata Party under Prime Minister Modi, has become scimitar waving Hindu nationalists. They want to cleanse India of all non-Hindus. They want to bring in what they call Hindutva, which is Hinduness, as a national theory. They want to deny the religions, the other religions in India, which are many. So they've heated up the situation, and they've just clamped down, divided Kashmir into two parts. Formerly it was autonomous, now, and they are really pressing down hard on the Muslims of Kashmir and denying them what few rights they had.
Mm. Man, you know, it sounds like the potential for catastrophe there is almost limitless. You know, I don't remember my footnote, so maybe I'm wrong, but also it makes sense when I think about it too, so I'll go ahead and say it out loud that I read a thing that said that the second largest Muslim population in the world is in India. Majority Hindu India, but hey, it's a big country. And that's first is Indonesia, and then the second most, the second largest group of Muslims in any nation in the world is in India. And so if you're going to cleanse India of Muslims, you're talking about Trail of Tears of absolutely catastrophic proportions.
Absolutely, Scott. If memory serves me, it's 140 million Muslims. Don't let Donald Trump hear that. 140 million Muslims live in India and coexist very uneasily with the Hindu majority, which discriminates against them. They hold pogroms and purges, and also constitutes the lowest income portion in India. So it's a major social and political problem.
And even if I think there must be, you know, and I've read a little bit about this, that there is somewhat geographical separation already. You know, obviously there's going to be a lot of mixing and overlap and everything, but we're not talking about, you know, Modi and them saying, okay, these provinces could go ahead and secede because we're better off without you, anything like that. They want to keep all the land, just kick the tens of millions of people off of it.
That's right. And they never expressed clearly how they're going to do it. They want to do something similar in Kashmir. Well, they've started because they divided it into two, and they made one state for Hindus and or Pandits, as they're called there, and one for Muslims, mm-hmm. Kashmiri Muslims.
I wish I knew enough to ask better questions about all this. I read a thing that said that the Chinese were being very conciliatory about this and were playing it down and saying, hey, I don't know their exact language, but diplomatically speaking, let's not fight. Let's not escalate this. Nobody wants to fight about this right now anyway. So
they
that's
do.
Pretty
it's,
good, right?
I don't think the Chinese want a war right now, particularly with the COVID virus situation. But they want to send a message as usual. And the message is as follows. Go easy on Kashmir. Stop trying to crush the Kashmiri Muslims because they're best friends with our buddies in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. That's great importance to China. Yeah. Even more important is the fact that the Trump administration has been playing footsie with India.
Oh, man, that was going to be my next question.
I'm sorry, I take it back.
Go ahead. Go ahead. You already ruined it.
I'm sorry, Scott. Trump has been trying to, who hates Muslims, and has been trying to build up India as an anti-China force in the event of a war. And a war is going to happen. We're headed towards a war, and we're just planning for it. And they're trying to mobilize and arm India. And the Chinese really don't like this because they know perfectly well what's going on. And this is probably the major reason for the unrest right now.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I saw that the Chinese were certainly blaming the Americans for intervening there. And now, what does America have to gain there other than just harassing the Chinese?
Well, in the event of a war, India would attack, or they hope India would attack, China's western regions, Xinjiang and Tibet, very, very sensitive for the Chinese, who have militarized the Tibetan plateau like crazy. And it would tie up millions of Chinese troops. So plus the Indian Navy and Air Force would play a key role. India is a major military power. There's not a bunch of guys running around with turbans. It's powerful. They've got big Air Force, lots of tanks and heavy artillery. Yeah. So this would be a big asset to the U.S. The U.S. can't fight China alone. It needs an Asian land ally.
Yeah, but of course, that just means that they are outsourcing the decision to go to war to somebody else. So, in other words, if we wanted to pick a fight with China, we want to count on India to help us. But that also means that if India gets in a fight with China, I mean, we obviously don't have any official treaty with them or anything, but in the event of a crisis, it's pretty easy to imagine, isn't it, that the American president would start leveling ultimatums against China, that they better not do this or that or else. And then at that point, die or cast.
To my shock and dismay, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, Trump announced he was ready to negotiate the whole Kashmir problem. God help us. And, since 1948, they haven't been able to solve it.
I didn't see that he had said that. I mean, what's funny is, without all this ridiculous world empire stuff, if America was a limited constitutional republic with a neutral foreign policy, that to me would be our highest priority, would be to host a completely neutral summit to try to solve Kashmir. And they could fly back and forth between New York and Geneva and whatever other neutral countries and talk the thing to death until they figure out, some kind of arrangement where we could put an end to the violence there.
We are so right. As in my book, I said, and I've been saying ever since, that this is the world's most dangerous border, the Kashmir border. And there are millions of troops on both sides with nuclear weapons. And the Indians have been screaming to invade Pakistan and teach it a lesson. And the PACs have all their nuclear weapons to stop the Indians from doing that, even though they outnumber Pakistan. But the danger is we need American diplomacy to defuse that issue. But we have no neutrality in the situation, as you rightly point out. We're too much in bed with India. We're too anti-Muslim. Look at Trump just reportedly, according to Bolton, who's not a trustworthy source either, claimed that it was okay, told the Chinese leader Xi Jinping that the concentration camps that China set up for Xinjiang Muslims are okay with him. So this is not an honest market, honest broker.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I believe that. I mean, I would believe it about Trump, but I don't believe a word that John Bolton says, you know.
He's an unreliable source. He's a horrible little man, but who knows?
Yeah, but I could see Trump saying, yeah, I don't care about that. I never heard of a Xinjiang province anyway, so whatever. You know, yeah. What does he care? He doesn't care. Same thing with the wheat. If you please buy wheat, that'll help me get reelected. I could see Trump doing that. But again, I'm not willing to take Bolton's word for it. In fact, it sounds not true coming from Bolton. Even though, do I think Trump's the kind of guy where he just would not recognize any line between his presidential campaign and official U.S. policy? You know, he's the kind of guy to do that, sure. But this isn't evidence of it. This is just a thing a guy said.
It sounds believable to me.
Yeah.
But I remember, of course, that the Republicans and my beloved President Eisenhower, who I have great respect, they used to go through a Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Taft Benson. I don't know if you remember that name from long ago. And they used to hand out millions and millions of dollars of subsidies and farm relief to these same Republican farmers, and who would bring that whole region in for the Republicans.
Yep, just like in Joseph Heller in Catch-22 about his father got paid by the government to not grow alfalfa, and that was his career. And then, but if the government paid anybody else anything to do anything, why, that was creeping socialism.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, crazy. Man. What a great job not growing alfalfa. Anyways, we're a little bit off topic, but I'm having fun. A couple of tangents away from the real question, which, in fact, I don't know if you saw this. Actually, I didn't see it either, but Eric Garris told me, so it must be right, that Trump said yesterday, we might just cut off all commercial and economic relationships and interdependence with China because we're so sick and tired of them. Which, I mean, I guess there is a lot he could do to affect that change if he really implements that as a policy. I'm not sure what that would look like, especially in the middle of a Great Depression. I mean, maybe it's the best time to do something like that if you're going to do it, but it seems like it would make the problem a lot worse.
Well, given the Trump campaign's beating the war drums over China and making it the central theme of the Trump campaign, we've got to stop those red Chinese bastards. It's possible. It's reckless beyond belief. But God help us. I don't know how the U.S. is going to come through this big mess. And you had COVID and Trump together, and I shudder.
You know, there's all these academic-type models about receding powers and rising powers and stuff. And that wasn't really the case with the Soviet Union, right? They were an established power. They weren't really rising or expanding, certainly not into America's core sphere of influence and all that. You know, containment and all that is pretty overblown when so much of the world was non-aligned and that kind of thing.
That's right, but, Scott. They were a minor challenge to the U.S.
But the problem with the rise of China is... And I think they'd be nuts, and they might be, but they'd be nuts and stupid, and they might be, but I don't bet on it. I don't think that they are. They would be crazy to expand their empire and to follow the American model of mass murder suicide here that our government has embarked on over just the last 30 years, never mind during the Cold War days, but just since the Cold War. But the Americans clearly, as they've blown their whole wad in the Middle East and discredited all of their own power in so many ways, and the empire and the other countries who are dependent on it and all the satellite relationships client-state relationships are all more tenuous now and all these things. They want to blame Trump for that, but it's because of the failures of the policies over the last 30 years, not just his, that they are kind of projecting onto China that these guys are going to make all the money and they're going to, and because of their very efficient and wonderful police state, they'll be able to, you know, keep prices very low and end up, they'll end up affording to dominate all of Eurasia, which is supposed to be our job. And we can't let them get away with it. And yet at the same time, they're obviously pretty certain that there's nothing that they can really do to stop it. And yet both sides, of course, as goes without saying, are armed to the teeth with H-bombs. And so it's a different dynamic than any that we faced, right? This is, we've ever since we've had atomic weapons, America's been the world empire. Now they're sort of being forced to cede to this rising power. Again, I think they're exaggerating it, but still. But they can't stand it. And they won't stand for it. So, you know, I don't know. I could see why that would immediately, you know, calculate into a pivot to Asia under Obama and even, you know, helping encourage the Indians to pick a fight there in South Asia right now and anything that they can do to try to frustrate the Chinese. But not to coin a phrase, but it seems like a fool's errand and possibly an extremely dangerous one.
Scott, as a observer of military affairs and a commentator on the subject, I am amazed by how much we're set on a course of military confrontation with China. All the new weapons that are coming out, this tactics, doctrine, as it's called, are all designed to fight a war, an offshore war off the coast of China. And attack China everywhere that we can. So, you know, it's ironic. I mentioned even in my book the so-called training camps that were found in Afghanistan that were Al-Qaeda training camps and these were actually for training Uyghur Muslims from China,
right,
by the CIA. To attack China if the balloon went up. And this is becoming institutionalized. The whole American military is now repositioning its thinking for war with China. So if you think about it long enough, it may happen.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's just the failure of imagination to see that, like, hey, for the next 10,000 years, the world's got to be big enough for us and them forever.
I think,
or else what? You know.
Well, in War at the Top of the World, my book, I wrote at the end of the book, the most important American foreign policy objective is going to be disengaging peacefully from Asia, mm-hmm. from get offshore and go back into the Pacific, and to just leave politely. Without a conflict with China. This is not happening yet.
Yeah, sounds like wisdom to me. Although, you know, Andrew Bacevich, I put that to him, and he thinks we ought to absolutely get out of Europe and quit messing with the Russians. I'm pretty sure. Certainly that we should get out of the Middle East entirely.
Leave Iran alone.
But he says, no, we got to stay in Korea and Japan because, man, if we let the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans settle things among themselves without, you know, standing in between them all, then there's going to be trouble. And the current situation of American dominance there is less worse than the alternative. What do you think of that?
Well, that's an argument that has some validity. I agree with it. As a Korea watcher, I know that America's footprint there is important, maintaining the status quo. But that doesn't mean that when the balloon goes up there, that will prevent a bigger war. And there's no doubt that America is losing the ability to finance having 100,000 troops spread between Korea and Japan. It's got to do some economies, just the way Trump is talking about reducing troops in Europe, which is an excellent idea.
Right.
I wish him speed.
Yeah, it's too bad we couldn't figure out a great campaign to support that when that came out. That, like, hooray, you know, mysteriously, thousands of balloons went up in major cities across America in the midst of the Black Lives Matter protest. It was the anti-war movement celebrating the removal of troops from Germany.
But Exactly. Well, we've overstretched our empire. That happens to all empires. And we can't afford to. We've got to start trimming at the edges.
Yeah, I say call off the whole thing and it'll probably work itself out.
Well, I think the Koreans and the Chinese are as good at managing the region and the Japanese as we are. Perhaps even better.
And again, you know what? With or without atomic weapons, everybody's got so much to lose. And I know that that's not a guarantee. There's World War One and a lot of examples, but still, there's a lot of incentive for these countries to get along. And who says that American dominance brings peace? Depends on who you ask. You know, speaking of the Japanese and the Koreans, you know.
Brings a Pax Americana. What happens if Kim Jong-un dies? You know, we're worried about his health crisis in Korea. Any of the thing could blow up into a really dangerous situation. And the Japanese are in a really awful situation because they're completely naked to Chinese power, and they will, I believe, eventually have to get nuclear weapons. I know. I was in the Ministry of Defense in Tokyo, and I saw a design for nuclear weapon. So I know the Japanese are thinking about nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? As long as we're on the subject here, we could point out that Trump really did, you know, break through, kick the door in on the chance to make peace with North Korea that his predecessors have. Well, Bill Clinton actually had a pretty good interim step there with the agreed framework of 94. But Bush and Obama have been just absolutely horrible on Korea. And Trump made major breakthroughs in terms of establishing a relationship with the dictator there and beginning negotiations. And they had the path forward that everyone could see. And we have to start dropping sanctions and giving war guarantees and opening up the relationship as much as we can. And hopefully we'll get to nuclear weapons. But the most important thing is establishing a peaceful relationship so that at the very least those nuclear weapons are less of a danger. And then instead, and they gave a speech. It was Stephen Biegun from the State Department gave a speech where he said, yeah, we recognize that. We're going to do the right thing. And then, nope, the policy was you have to give up all of your nukes first, and then we'll think about beginning to treat you fairly after that. Yeah, right. Which, in other words, the George W. Bush, Barack Obama policy of self-inflicted destruction of the negotiations. And then now they say, oh, those crazy old North Koreans, you just can't negotiate with them, when they had every opportunity in the world. And, you know, Trump appointed the swamp to run his foreign policy department. And so even though he really wanted to do this, he let them sabotage it, and sabotage it they did.
Bolton was a chief saboteur.
Oh, wait, I lost your audio there. Go ahead. Start again.
Oh. John Bolton was a prime sabotager of any accords with Korea. I mean, he really was a spear point of screwing them up. And he would try again, I think. The Koreans are not going to get rid of their nuclear weapons. They'd be crazy to do that. But they'd also be even more crazy to launch them in the United States. So they're only useful as long as they're sitting on the ground with electricity going through them.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. We don't sit around cowering about British or French or even Chinese nuclear weapons because, yeah, we get along with them. They're not threatening us with them.
Or Indian or Israeli nuclear weapons. You're quite right. And in fact, you know, as I point out periodically, we in the United States are in violation of the Strategic Nuclear Arms Weapons Treaty of, what was it, 1952?
Yeah, the Non-Proliferation Treaty or something else?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We're in violation because the treaty called for all nuclear powers to start getting rid of dismantling their nuclear arsenals.
Yep.
We never did that. Yep. But we're demanding that the Koreans do it.
Yep. And meanwhile, we're also pledged to respect the right of other countries to pursue nuclear technology for peaceful purposes, and yet we don't. Pretend the Iranians are building weapons when our government pretends the Iranians are building weapons when they know good and well that they're not, and that they're absolutely within the letter and the spirit of the law, and they go after them anyway.
That's right. Well, that's a whole separate issue. But I think the Korean nuclear weapons technology, missile and warhead technology, have all come from China. And the Chinese are right in there. So if we plan to do anything violent about North Korea, we better take into account dealing with the Red Chinese. And right next door, how many Americans know that right next door to North Korea is Russia?
Right. I mean, they do share a border. Mm-hmm.
Also, that's right. Their northern border is with the Russians.
And listen, when you say that, you know, it would be crazy for them to give up their nuclear weapons, you know, implying because what America might do to them if they didn't have them, that, I mean, because that might sound incredible to people or incredibly cynical to people who don't know. But when you mention how John Bolton had been such a detriment to the policy negotiation here, what he did was he said, we want to pursue the Libyan model. In fact, Trump has been trashing him on Twitter recently, saying he blew up the whole negotiation with that, which is true. And what that meant was that W. Bush had brought Gaddafi in from the cold in 2003 after, as you say, Gaddafi gave up all the junk that he bought from the Pakistanis just so he could give it up. Not that he had an actual nuclear program of any kind. But anyway, he gave all that up for a PR stunt for Bush to let him back in from the cold. And just a mere 8 years later, Barack Obama murdered him to death and overthrew and destroyed his country. And if that's the Libyan model, then obviously the message to the North Koreans that John Bolton was clearly deliberately trying to send was, you'd be a fool to trust us and negotiate away your nuclear capability, because he would prefer a confrontation. So it was a credible threat. In other words, he didn't just say, yeah, we might screw you over. He cited a country that we did this to just a couple of years before.
It was a hell of a good warning.
Yep. And they sure took it seriously.
They did. It made a lot of sense.
Yep. All right. Well, anyway, so I'm glad to hear that it sounds like you think that this current set of conflicts in the Himalayas are going to probably peter out, scale back down, right?
Right. Don't start restocking your bomb shelter yet. But it's something that we should keep an eye on. It's a fascinating conflict, and it's an area in the world that nobody knows anything about. So worth watching.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time again on the show, Eric. Great to talk to you.
Always enlightening talking to you, Scott. Cheers. Bye-bye.
All right, you guys, that is the great Eric Margolese. The books are War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And check out all his great articles at ericmargolese.com. Spell it like Margolis, ericmargolese.com.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.